My chronometer's running backwards, sir. Time warp. We're going backwards in time. Helm, begin reversing power.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Next Lander Watchcast. We are now on episode 4, and I think that means officially we have a podcast.
And the title, so yeah.
We worked out the title last time, but my inkling is always if you make it to episode 4, you're real, you're legitimate, you exist.
We have four episodes and a title and a growing young William Shatner fandom in this house.
Hell yes. But
not on my part.
I was going to say the same. I was talking to little Alex before, little Alex and big Alex before the show.
You don't get to talk to little Alex.
This was the episode I got it. This was the episode I got Kirk, I think.
You understand him both as a personality and as a sex symbol?
Mostly as a sex symbol.
Okay.
Kirk is hunky in this one. He's dashing.
The sex symbol aspect of this landed very hard for someone else here around the end of episode 4.
Okay, I was going to say, there's also a couple parts in episode 3 where I feel like maybe that could have also started to come together a little bit. But
3
yes.
was where it landed for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, where we have landed today is back into our Star Trek The Original Series rewatch. We are now up to episodes 3 and 4 of the original series run, and these include Where No Man Has Gone Before, which is the second pilot that was ordered and was aired third in the broadcast order, which I'm going to say is a fairly senseless choice, but hey, what do I know?
It's so different.
We'll get to it.
And the other, I'll let you finish.
Yeah, the other one is The Naked Time, one of the more infamous episodes of the series, both for behind-the-scenes chicanery and also just being one of the goofier episodes of the show. It is beloved in some ways, so much so that they straight up just did a remake of that episode on Next Generation when the series came around.
Not to put the cart before the horse. Well, I'll save it for until we get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. But
it's my favorite episode so far.
Yes, I can understand why, because it is definitely the first time we get a real good look at goofy-ass Star Trek. But before we get there, let's start things off with Where No Man Has Gone Before, the second pilot, the one that brought the series to order. Yet another plot about people getting special powers through space magic. And definitely one where you can tell that they had most of the pieces in place, but had not worked out everything yet.
They had a lot of the body parts, but not the bones.
Yes. No bones.
No bones tonight. Very nice. Let me start as someone, again, not that familiar with this series nor Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I get what they're doing with the title. I get that it is the whole intro bit, right?
Well, so this is where the intro bit came from.
So let me just say this so far. Every episode has been someplace man has been before. They are just the space cops and space investigators going to clean up stuff that has happened where people have gone before. They have yet to go and find something that has been unexplored territory.
Let me clarify here. In this case, the thing they're talking about is they find basically what I imagine is the flight recorder and logs of a ship called the USS Valiant that has extremely exploded. And it was 200 years ago was when it was lost. Mm-hmm. So this is pretty early in the spacefaring humanity range. And what they discover is that it was swept from its path by what they call a magnetic space storm. And then somewhere in there, the crew started frantically searching, like basically Googling ESP and people having extrasensory perception. And then at some point, the captain orders his own ship to self-destruct. So something real rotten happened.
In the record, yeah. That Spock has to listen to and then kind of yell out as he's real time listening to this. They can't play it over the loudspeaker for everybody.
I mean, there's a lot of Spock to get to here. I mean, they were definitely sort of feeling out who the character was and also trying to get across in a very ham-handed way who the character was.
Maybe he's translating. Like, maybe it's not in Universal, like, or whatever they speak.
Like, they just go so hard on the, like, Spock is a logic lord in this that I have to assume that, like, he's somehow able to, like, listen to some cacophony of nonsense on a thing and just understand it.
Yes.
Yeah, and this seems to be a situation where it's like, it's not like Next Generation, where anytime they find logs, there is just reams and reams of text for Data to read through.
Right.
I'm guessing these are audio logs that he's just listening to. Like, basically, you know, hey, you found a cassette tape in a yeah. first-person shooter, and now you're listening right. to their audio logs.
Yeah, but like he's almost treated so much like a walking computer in this that I would not be shocked if that's what they were trying to go for there, of just like, oh, he can listen to this mess of chaos and like glean meaning from it.
So before we get too far into the plot here, I want to give a little background information that also maybe explains a little bit about where they go with Spock in this episode. So this was the second pilot. This is the one that brought it to the series. Gene Roddenberry had three episode treatments that he was looking at the time. One that became the episode Mud's Women, which I think is going to be in our next Star Trek episode.
Oh,
I think that's episode six. Yeah, Mud is a recurring character. This is the that would be his first appearance in the series. The other is a season, an episode that did not become an actual episode until season two, called The Omega Glory, and this one. And this one was written by screenwriter Samuel Peeples, who is mostly a TV writer, did stuff like Tales of Wells Fargo, The Rough Riders, Flash Gordon. He wrote the script, everyone kind of loved it, then Roddenberry rewrote a bunch of it, which he didn't love. He says he very firmly is the one who came up with the phrase, "where no man has gone before," despite the fact that Roddenberry also kind of says that he did it. And
of course
so
he did.
Yeah. So when filming this pilot, they could not get the actor who played Captain Pike to come back. He did not want to do it.
Oh, wow. They originally wanted him back?
They did. Jeffrey Hunter.
Oh, shit.
So Jeffrey Hunter, I think, did that pilot, the first one, when he was kind of in between stuff in his film career. And so he was like, I don't really want to go be on a full-time TV series, so I'm just not going to do this.
And when you talk about being the second pilot, again, just for people like myself who are not that familiar, the first one being the one with Pike that never aired officially in this season.
Yes, it's
right?
the one that appears in flashbacks in a later episode this season, but it was never officially aired. Obviously, it appeared on all the like the Blu-ray releases and is on like streaming now. But yeah, so Kirk was created, and originally they were talking about getting Jack Lord or alumnus from my high school, Lloyd Bridges, to play James Kirk. And then they got Shatner for it, which is, you know, kind of hard to imagine anyone else. This is the... So originally, Spock was not... So, okay, I've watched The Cage. My recollection is that Vulcans were still fairly emotionless creatures, even in that original The Cage pilot. But apparently, Spock is also... In this pilot and kind of going forward is sort of an amalgamation of what he originally was in The Cage and this other character who was the original first officer that was played by Majel Barrett, who eventually became Gene Roddenberry's wife and also plays Nurse Chapel in the next episode we'll get to.
Mm-hmm.
She was just known as Number One, and she was the first officer originally, and then they just... The network was, like, trying to get rid of both those characters, and Roddenberry went to bat for Spock.
Okay.
So he combined some of the personality elements, I think, to Spock. Apparently NBC was really weirded out by Spock, thought he was satanic-looking.
Okay. I mean, I get it. The eyebrows.
The eyebrows in this are just out of completely out of control.
They are severe.
Did he shave his eyebrows, or are those false eyebrows?
Yeah, those are absolutely
that are like,
yeah, he's
they
got
go like
half
halfway
real
up,
eyebrows.
They go like halfway up the forehead.
Yeah, yeah, but the rest of it's shaved off, or is it makeup? Is it like, do we know? Is that
I think the
like
rest
Star
is
Trek?
Makeup.
Okay. Yeah, that's severe in this one. Also, is this the one where he's green?
He's not. I mean, he's wearing the yellow.
Yeah, it's
like sweater.
What's the
okay?
Oh, wait, are you talking about...
I was talking skin pigment.
Yeah, is it pancake makeup? Is that what you call it in TV? I forget what the...
Something
yeah,
is caked
it
on.
Is.
Like,
it is very
got,
caked on.
He's got really heavy makeup on in this.
Yeah.
Like, which makes me... I wonder if that was intentional?
Yeah, like, it could have been.
This
trying
is a weird one watching...
Alien.
Like, watching in high def. I mean, you said, like, when we first started, like, color TV was not that prolific when this started, right?
Yes.
So, like, who knows, like, what decisions they were making for what... they expected people to be watching on then versus what like this HD restoration looks like now.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I can't tell. I can't tell when people are colored green or not because of the colorblind stuff, but I knew that dude had a lot of makeup on in this one.
Yeah, I would say there is definitely like a slightly more yellowish tint to his skin, but which they kind of get rid of past that episode. But yeah. I think they're just trying to make him look more alien, ultimately.
Okay.
Also, everybody's wearing these, like, they're not exactly turtlenecks, but these kind of
like
lumpy sweater.
They're very lumpy.
Like these, like those. The uniform, like the tunic kind of like hangs. It's not very form-fitting.
There are zippers in this one on people's uniforms that are like, you never see those again.
Yeah.
It's just...
And this episode marks the first significant appearances of James Doohan as Scotty, who actually gets some lines this time.
Extremely happy to see Scotty show up.
And George Takei as Sulu is as the one time he is an astrophysicist in this series and not the pilot.
Okay, I thought that was the case.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was in a different role.
Scotty, not Scottish, right?
James Doohan is not Scottish. I think he's Canadian.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
So he's putting on the accent.
He is definitely putting on the accent for Scotty, but basically James Doohan basically just talked like that pretty much for the rest of his life, I feel like.
Okay. All right,
I don't think
enough.
I've ever heard him talk in a way that did not have him doing at least a little bit of that voice.
Okay. Just wanted to, just again.
I'm gonna double check. I want to make sure James Doohan is actually Canadian, because I don't want to get that wrong.
I feel like I absorbed that somewhere. Probably from
he's
wife.
From Vancouver originally.
Okay, but not like by way of Scotland.
I mean his family could be Scottish. There's a lot of Scottish immigrants in Canada, so it could be, but
okay. Scotty.
I know this because my dad was rambling about it a bunch last time I was home. Like he was like heavily sort of decorated in World War II.
Mm.
Like he was part of the Normandy landing on D-Day and stuff.
Oh wow. Okay.
He was also good friends with one of the producers of original Star Trek, which is how he got the role in the first place.
Okay. He seems fairly young in this. So he must have been in his like 40s.
He's probably in his late 30s, early 40s, I would guess.
Okay.
No Uhura yet. She does not come on until the series is brought to order. And obviously no McCoy. There's a different ship doctor played by Paul Fix, who I had never really heard of before, but he was an extremely prolific actor starting in the 1920s on. And he acted all the way into the late 70s.
He seemed very familiar. I don't know from where. He seemed like he could have played like Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman somewhere.
Totally. He did a ton of black and white cinema from like the 20s to the 40s. So, and then
he was good.
Yeah, he's fine. But obviously, I can kind of understand why maybe they redid that role, because there's just not a lot of personality there.
Yeah, yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. Is he's just kind of there. You prompted me when you said like the ship had exploded 200 years previously, to finally look up exactly when the show takes place.
Yes. Where in the timeline?
I thought it was around late 2200s or something, but it's actually exactly 300 years after the air date. So 2265.
Oh, okay. Oh, that makes sense.
Okay.
Is when the show is set.
Okay.
For what it's so this ship would have exploded only like 100 years, roughly 50-ish years from now.
I'm trying to remember the timeline, because, again, Enterprise is the series that gets furthest into the, hey, Earth people getting into space with regularity timeline. But my recollection is that we are pretty close to the Bell Riots and all the stuff that basically shook current human society loose.
I think we may actually be past them, or that's 2024, maybe.
It's pretty close. And then the nuclear... And then the nuclear war that turns humanity into a bunch of, like, countryless factions is later this century.
Yeah, World War III, essentially.
Yeah.
The nuclear World War III. Of course, I mean, whatever. It's like, A, it's dumb. It's all kind of hokey. But B, also, like, in their timeline, there were, like, the eugenics wars took place in the 90s and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, like, things, obviously.
A lot of things did not come to pass that Gene Roddenberry predicted.
Anyway, I mostly just want to look that up, because I've always appreciated that they thought to set it way far out and not quite give themselves the same problem of like, oh, this will be happening 60 years from now. We're sure of it. Like, no, 300 years, like, okay, sure.
In the far-flung future of 1992.
Right.
This episode also features a couple of notable guest stars. Gary Lockwood plays Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell. If you recognize Gary Lockwood from anything, and it isn't just because you used to watch a lot of Westerns in the 50s and 60s, You may remember him as one of the two main astronauts from 2001 A Space Odyssey that are on the ship with Hal.
Yes.
He's the one who gets jettisoned into space.
Yes, okay. He did look familiar.
And then the other one is Sally Kellerman as Dr. Elizabeth Danner. She, I'm guessing if you recognize her, it is probably from the MASH movie as Hot Lips Houlihan.
Okay,
but she has also done a ton of television acting and some various various TV roles as well, like Outer Limits and Twilight Zone. And they are, you know, they are kind of presented here, if not as main cast, but definitely as like central characters to this story. But they are not going to be long for this episode.
Dude, Star Trek loves its omnipotent beings so much.
Yep. Superpowers.
There is one other character here that I was hoping you could fill in a blank for me with. Smith, or whoever is hanging out behind Kirk, standing behind Kirk.
Ah, yes, Yeoman Smith, played by Andrea Drom.
Yeah, I looked her up. Yeah, she's only in like another episode briefly, and then
what is her deal? Why is
so? That's Yeoman. That's basically what Yeoman Rand turned into.
Oh,
like
okay.
she is like sort of the assistant, like administrative assistant of the bridge. But they recast that role and gave her more of a personality when they went to series.
He gets her name wrong.
Yes, he does.
Jones.
I mean, she has almost nothing to do in this episode.
She stands so close to just hanging out there. She just looks like comic relief almost. Like she's just like comically close to Kirk and then in the way, just a space intern on the ship.
So
really weird.
So the plot kicks off. They go to where this is, and they kind of allude that where this ship's wreckage is essentially pretty close to what is considered the barrier for the galaxy.
Yeah, like the edge of the galaxy or something like that.
Like as far as anyone has traveled toward the end of what is essentially the Milky Way.
Mm.
And what they find there is a giant barrier. Like it's just a giant energy barrier that they make the extremely good decision to just fly the fuck into.
Why do they do that?
Kirk's, I think Kirk's thing is that, like, we have to find out what happened to this ship, so we should try it.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's exactly it.
Okay.
Yeah, he flat out says, like, other ships will be this way eventually. Like, they need to know what to expect.
Comments?
The only fact we have for sure is that the SS Valiant was destroyed.
Probably the best argument to continue the probe. Other vessels will be heading out here someday. They'll have to know what they'll be facing. We're leaving the galaxy, Mr. Mitchell. Ahead, warp factor one.
They've got all these sensors and probes and just go through. All right.
Yeah, sending a probe is probably the thing I would do first if it were me. But, you know, maybe
I've got to move
Kirk's
the plot
way
forward. Yeah. And the ship.
So they fly into the barrier of known space. It goes real bad for them. They have to retreat. And then a bunch of stuff on the ship explodes. And also two people on the ship, namely Gary and Alice there. Elizabeth. They get knocked around. And it's alluded to early on that they in their Starfleet files, they are sensitive to ESP, though do not have fully formed powers.
Please, it is not alluded to. I think Elizabeth says it is known fact that some people can predict the future. Like, known
or sensitive
fact,
to things.
To predicting, like, you know, seeing the back of a card or something.
Yes.
Dr. Dana, how are you on ESP?
In tests, I've taken my ESP rated rather high.
I'm asking what you know about ESP.
It is a fact that some people can sense future happenings, read the backs of playing cards and so on. But the Esper capacity is always quite limited.
What future? Well, I thought we were in a scientific future here. Why is Elizabeth going around saying ESP is proven fact?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, it's such a nascent concept, even at this stage of the future, that I imagine is, like, one of those, like, light evolution things of there is a certain number of people that kind of... Like, it's the people who are whatever the force sensitivity and mass effect is, you know? Like, biotics.
All right, like we're getting, it's just kind of below the surface somewhere?
Yeah, but then this energy field brings it all the way to the surface, and, you know, like, their power, they, like, Gary gets knocked out real hard and wakes up with silver fucking eyes.
I fucking hate this whole thing. This is where I got off on the episode.
You just didn't like the idea of like wearing those contacts, did you?
Oh my god, they look so painful. He never can open his eyes. He's always looking from the bottom of his eyes the entire... They look, they're tearing up. Like, this is some... This felt to me like some like Tin Man shit like from The Wizard of Oz where it's like, oh, this is bad for your health. Whatever you're doing right now is no good. Your body paint slash tinfoil in your eyeballs is bad.
These kinds of lenses, they're called scleral lenses. They cover the entire eye. The modern version of these are fine. They are actually totally normal to use on your eyes. They don't do any damage. But in the 60s, the version they had were not very...
Stop.
They were not breathable.
Mm.
So it's not that they were necessarily doing damage, but like they could do damage if left in too long.
Okay.
And in this case, what they did was they took tin foil and they laminated it between two pieces of lens.
Okay.
So none of the foil was touching their eyes, but like it was in there and there was only a tiny hole to look through.
Oh.
And apparently, like, Sally Kellerman didn't have any major issues. She also didn't have to wear them as much, but apparently Gary Lockwood could not see out of them. And so that's why he's always doing the I'm looking up, I'm kind of looking yeah. around kind of thing.
Yes.
And he decided to just use that in his performance. Like he's
okay.
like in a way he's kind of like observing these people like they're, you know, like they're ants,
him.
You know, like
yeah,
they're bugs.
Definitely gives them an extra like otherworldly kind of creepy quality.
Brad, you'll probably appreciate this. She constantly goes around saying, you know, ESP, 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 and then starts saying Espers.
Yeah, they keep using
and I was
the
like,
term Espers.
Holy cow, is Espers just ESP from like Final Fantasy? Is that what we're like, are like Espers supposed to be extrasensory perception? Is that what we're doing here?
Maybe.
It was possibly a Phoenix Down-ish moment for me of I had never really heard the term Esper before. And also never heard it linked to ESP.
I so had now, not either, so...
ESPers, Espers.
I don't think ESP comes up too much more in this series, to be fair. This seems like one of those things they wrote for an episode and then they just never really touch. Not on this in this specific context again.
I think they might have made it up for this. I'm not...
Cool. The term Esper?
I'm trying to find some other reference to somebody using it that way, and I'm not really seeing anything.
Is it all Final Fantasy?
Probably. But so, okay, so Gary gets the powers right away. Like,
well, Gary gets put in sick bay, but yeah, he's
But as soon as he wakes
quick.
Up, like, he's reading at an incredible rate, he's retaining knowledge at an incredible rate, he starts developing the ability to move objects with his mind, and as they say, he's evolving at basically a geometric rate. Like, he's just going to keep getting more and more powerful.
Can we talk about the great computer screens that are basically microfiche?
Yes.
They have computer screens in front of them, which are basically just pulling scans of printed material up in front of them in a way that they must have known what a digital display looked like at the time, but was this just more efficient to use?
I have to imagine that showing any kind of real digital display was probably too expensive. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, everything was a CRT back then. It was, like, kind of...
Probably pretty tough.
Small screens, too, for sure.
Okay. It was just very funny, because Gary has a book in front of him that's supposed to be reading, and he pushes the screen away and turns the light off, and you could still see the overlay on the screen there, even when he turns the light off. Like, clearly, they just put the text overlaid on a backlit screen. What are you going
to
do?
I find you really just have to look past all the technology and design stuff in this series.
I loved it.
Like... Even the decor of the starship is so painful.
It's a very small viewing window in this episode, like on the port screen. Like
the screen, like the big screen, is not as big as it is later in the series. I think they reused a lot of the sets from the cage, or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe they didn't actually reuse much. I'm not sure, but yeah, they redesigned some stuff when they got to series order and started producing a bunch of these episodes. But we do get another 3D chess scene with Spock and Kirk at the beginning.
Yep.
We get
Kirk beats him again.
We get the mess hall. Yeah.
That's right.
He
also is able early on. He's able to control his autonomic functions. He's able to like stop his own heart and stuff like that.
Yep.
Which
Gary's a monster.
Both of these episodes have extensive sickbay. Like extensive patients in sickbay, and it made me realize how incredibly ominous and almost musical the heartbeat monitor is in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like a bum, bum, bum. It's like this almost ominous, you know. Like it almost acts as this like ominous building musical percussionish kind of thing in the background of these tense sickbay scenes. It works really well.
It works really well, and it's interesting. Like, going back, I remembered early Star Trek being fairly cacophonous. Like, the sound design of the bridge, like, the med bay, like, everywhere. Like, there's just so much background noise and beeps and bloops and various things. They completely abandon that in Next Generation. Like, there are areas that are noisier than others, but almost all of it is that, like, calming thrum underneath and just a little bit of, like, instrument noise. And it's just interesting. It's, like, it's just such a divergence from, like, what they established, which is just computer noise everywhere.
Yeah, computer noise, but, like, no engine noise. Like,
yeah.
If you're in a room with no computers whizzing and stuff, it's, like, dead silent.
The only time you hear the engine noise is when, like, they're ramping up the engines.
It's, the sound design is, I find, to be totally fine and fun. The shots in this one are a little more, they're less, it doesn't have that severe lighting that the other episodes get. Because the one after this also has it, where it has the Morticia Adams, like,
yeah.
Band of light. This episode does not have any of that. And even this one has, like, a top-down shot that I didn't see in any of the other episodes.
I like that shot. I kind of wish
they're
did
getting
more
in the elevator.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, there's a camera in the rafters somewhere. But a lot of this episode also takes place in Gary's sickbed.
Yes, he's there for a while.
He's there most of the time.
As he keeps getting more and more powerful. Meanwhile, you know, so far, Elizabeth Danner has not displayed any powers, but she is definitely, like, really interested in Gary, like, both from a psychological standpoint and also seemingly for other reasons.
She seems to have some ideas about, you know, it's kind of superhuman evolution and a better That's version right. of man and stuff like that.
Dude, the blank stares she gets from everyone in on the senior staff when she's like, what if this is, you know, the dawning of a superior yes. version of human? And everyone's just like, are you some kind of fucking Nazi? What are you talking
yeah,
about?
Like there are definitely some, like, creepy quasi-eugenics sort of
yes.
arguments
yeah.
being made.
Are they right, Doctor? Has he shown abilities of such magnitude?
I saw some such indications.
And you didn't think it worth mentioning?
No one's been hurt, have they? Don't you understand? A mutated superior man could also be a wonderful thing. The forerunner of a new and better kind of human being.
It's a pretty good scene where it was like, anyway, we're gonna... Because they realize that Gary is kind of getting past where it's maybe safe or sensible to have somebody who considers himself a god on a ship, and they have to figure out what to do. And then you get some real cold Spock-ass shit.
Oh, yeah. And, like, the better of the two solutions is still cold as fuck,
yeah.
which is maroon him on this mining planet, which, Vinny, you must have loved this place. The idea of a completely automated mining planet that only, like, people come to pick up fucking junk every 20 years.
I did, but it also, you build a lot of consoles and windows into a place that has no humans. It seems very wasteful. Like, when they go down there, it's got all these
consoles
gotta,
there's
got to
be the machines, and someone's got to repair them, so they got to have the tool set to repair them.
Windows cost money, man.
Yeah. I got to say, before we move on from, like, when they're debating what to do with him, like, strand him on the planet or kill him or whatever. Like,
yeah, that is the other option. Kill him right now.
It feels like another aspect or another example of, like, Spock not being fully fleshed out or defined yet, because, like, in this, he's just straight up amoral. Like,
right.
he has no morality. He is just kill him. Like, yes. Of course. Like, I am a being of pure logic. We should kill him. Like, you know, later on, Spock had morality.
Right.
So, like, he's got a line in this one that's, I wrote it down, ancestors married a human female in this one.
So that gets elaborated upon and eventually transmorphs into Spock's mom is human.
Okay, that's what I picked up through osmosis over the years.
Yes.
That, I thought his mom was human. So that's officially canonical that his mom
yes.
is, okay. Because I think that comes up in the next episode, too, where
yes, his half-human nature is definitely brought up more thoroughly in the next episode.
Where everybody gets their Emmy.
Mm-hmm.
But, that part is cold. He's cold in this one. He is not messing around, being of pure logic.
Yeah.
And if we didn't say it before, Kirk and Gary have a kind of long history of going, Kirk was like a teacher or something as Gary was going through the academy and their friends. And
yeah, he was, I don't know if Kirk had graduated at this point or was just waiting to get assigned to a ship or something, but he was like a fairly low ranking Starfleet officer at the time that was doing teaching at the academy. And Gary was one of the people who came through his class.
Yeah. And so he's, you know, there's conflict there between Kirk's emotional ties to Gary and Spock's just ice cold. And the, like, you have two options.
The thing I'll give Spock here is that he correctly reads the situation, which is that this is basically not Gary anymore. When the silver eyes are on and he is like, you know, like there are moments where like his powers are drained and he kind of goes back to normal. That's Gary. But once he has this, whatever is inside of him, it's essentially, it takes him over and whatever personality was there before is all but gone.
Good acting from that actor. Like,
yeah,
that first time that he gets zapped by the force field and his eyes go normal for a second, like for that second, he's like Kirk, like he's just waking up from something. Like the delivery on that is very much like, oh my God, I'm trapped in here. Like, please.
Scary. Yeah.
This is a very ominous character and performance.
Get some good shit flying across the room. Mm-hmm. A couple of cups here and there, some weapons flying across. They have a water dispenser just, you know, on the wall of the sick bay, which was nice to just have poking through a wall.
I think the spray bottles are in the Naked Time, but there's like a bunch of weird modern shit lying around in this show. Like that water spigot is just a spigot.
I think at one time, I don't remember if it's this episode or another one, they're in the mess hall and there's just a straight up coffee maker. Right. Like, it's not even like a futuristic looking coffee maker. It's just coffee maker.
Like, come on. You couldn't think of some 300 years from now method of delivering water, really?
Yeah.
And they have, I think they introduce it in this one and it's in the next one, or I just caught sight of it in this one and it's been in all of them. The weird kids colored blocks that they used for Data. Like, they have stacks of them. They look
when he's in the Jeffries tube and he's like putting stuff.
No, not that.
Oh, that's later. Okay.
Yeah, that's later. No, they plug them into things. Like when somebody gets food, they put them in there. When they're
they're like punch cards, basically. They're
punch cards, but they're all like kid. They look like they're primary colored kids blocks.
I assume those are just like ration cards. Like you plug it in the computer and then the food spits out.
Or data chits or something. Yeah. They're it's interesting. I wonder if they are just blocks painted color or they went a little further.
Yeah.
My wife was watching me, she was like, Are those 3.5? Are those floppies? I was like, definitely not.
No.
Like, we are not in that rate. We got another 30 years before those kind of.
If those existed at all, you were not paying money to put those onto a TV set. That was not happening.
I was like, a disc is about 8 times the size of that by at this point.
Yeah.
So those data, always funny.
So they find a way to get him down onto the mining planet. They get him into what is essentially the brig, which apparently there's a brig also on this unmanned planet. Mm-hmm. They just force field him in there. And meanwhile, they're trying to pull parts from this thing to repair the ship so they can get the fuck out of there. I just want to very briefly call mention to the absolutely ludicrous phaser rifle that Spock is carrying around for half this episode.
That was like,
I have seen like industrial strength sex toys that looked less ridiculous than this thing did.
It was the super soaker of future like laser rifles. The thing was so over engineered.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous.
I feel like that version of it doesn't come back, but I could be wrong.
Sorry, I literally had that scene queued up unintentionally when you started talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, the way that was a good laugh out loud, the way that plays out. Like, Scotty's on the comm going, oh, by the way, did Mr. Spock get the phaser rifle he requisitioned? Kirk's like, I didn't order any. Like, Spock just strides through the door with that thing strapped to his waist.
Stone-faced, yes.
And it looks so ridiculous.
Is he Mr. Spock, not Dr. Spock, right? Dr. Spock being the child,
yes.
It's always Mr. Spock in Star Trek?
Yeah, he's a science officer, but he's always referred to as Mr. Spock.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Yeah, they never use his rank, do they?
I feel like there's a point where he becomes captain rank and then eventually admiral rank, and then they start referring to him that way, but like, on this series, I'm not sure they ever really talk about what his rank is, other than he's first officer.
Yeah, because they're always trying to play up the Kirk and Spock are friends angle, right?
Yeah.
Does he always say, like, sensor and deflector in that manner?
I think that was another one of those things they were amping up to make him weird and alien in this.
Okay. The over-enunciation.
It's on our sensor. And like, okay, you've got to have to calm down, Mr. Spock.
I mean, I don't. Maybe you would agree with me, Brad, on this, since you've seen a lot of Next Generation. I feel like the early goings for Spock are very similar to the early goings for Data, in the sense like, there is a framework there that holds for the rest of the series, but, like, the levels they operate at in terms of, like, what is an actual emotional response for this character, what are they capable of, changes pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's the opposite for Data, though, because that series, he actually is more human at the beginning, and then over time, he became just a walking computer.
Yeah.
I'll say this. He commits. I feel like Nimoy is committed in
I think he's the best actor anywhere on this series.
Yeah, like, he's all in.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for what he has to do, he's good. I like it. He sells what he's doing there.
So they're down on the planet.
In the brig, which is great because it has no wall or glass or anything, and they have to pretend, the guy has to pretend to break out of it and has to act against the nothing, which is also great.
Listen, acting against force fields that are not there is a time-honored tradition in Star Trek.
Okay, it was very good. But what, like, he's like exponentially growing stronger is the problem, right?
And they understand that at a certain point, he will be powerful enough to just, there will be nothing that can contain him.
Yes. Yeah, so this episode in the last 10-15 minutes just goes full classic 60s morality play.
Yes.
Like in text, like just verbalized.
Yes.
Kirk quite literally uses the phrase absolute power corrupting absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There'll only be one of you in the end. One jealous god. If all this makes a god. Or is it making him something else?
One last chance, Kirk.
You like what you see. Absolute power corrupting absolutely.
Yes.
It's all there, and he does get out, and also Elizabeth, she gets her powers eventually, and they start to wander around the planet looking at what might be in store for them if they end up having to stay there. But also, at this point, Gary can just manifest matter out of thin air, so he can just kind of turn the planet into whatever he wants.
Which he makes like a fucking suburban rock garden with a water feature in the backyard as his paradise, which is like, all right, Gary.
He's just trying it out for the first time. You know, give him some time.
There's an interesting... There's a thing that I don't know if this is direct reference or not. Periodically, the other people refer to them as mutants.
Yes.
Like, kind of just kind of refer to the, like, mutation of whatever whatever power they already had into something else. So, the X-Men came into existence just a few years before Star Trek came around. And there are parts of this that have a feeling that remind me a little bit of sort of, like, the Magneto...
Sure.
You know, sort of doctrine of, you know, why the fuck would we care about humans? We're so much better than them. They're basically ants to us.
And where the next step.
Yeah, and like I'm wondering if a little bit of the Gary character is maybe modeled. I mean, I'm not saying it definitely is. I haven't seen any actual like references to this anywhere. But it feels like it has a similar mentality of we're beyond whatever humanity you have, and therefore you do not matter to me.
Right, insects.
Yeah. But so we get them out on the planet. They're walking around. Kirk is going after them with this stupid fucking phaser rifle.
Full commando Kirk.
On his own, because everyone else has sort of been incapacitated or killed in the case of one of the other, in this case, yellow shirt, but...
Yes, I'm going to get strangled with a telekinetic cord.
Yeah.
But he told them to wait 12 hours and then bail, right?
Right.
And blow the planet.
That's right, blow the planet.
Because he put a self-destruct on there. Yeah.
So he goes after them, and conflict ensues... To the point where Gary is basically, you know, he's got the drop on Kirk. There's not really much Kirk can do to surprise him. Kirk's trying to find a way to kill him. It's not working out. They get into one of the all-time great fist fights, I'm going to say, that James T. Kirk ever gets into. Sorry, James R. Kirk in this case, because the tombstone that Gary makes for him, which is very poetic, has James R. Kirk on it.
Yeah, everything after they meet up in this last confrontation is just incredibly on the nose.
Is that a thing that is ever explained canonically? Did Gary just not know Kirk well enough to know it's? I mean, everybody knows James T. Kirk. That is, even I know that Tiberius, right? Is that just the thing they ever try to explain in some novel somewhere?
I bet there is an extended universe novel out there where there is a James alternate universe James R. Kirk or something. But it is,
or maybe it's a nickname Gary had for Kirk in school or something where he's like goofing on him. Like
I have a. You know? I have a DC Fontana quote here about this exact thing.
What is it?
Or actually, this is paraphrased. Let's see. According to DC Fontana, in the introduction to the classic episodes, number one, when the mistake over the middle initial was discovered, Gene Roddenberry decided that if pressed for an answer on the discrepancy, the response was to be, Gary Mitchell had godlike powers, but at base he was human. He made a mistake.
There you go.
All right.
Yeah. So, yeah, he goofed. He couldn't re-chisel that.
I mean, that's a hand wave, but, like, the way he goes out, actually, I was, like, kind of left going, wait a minute, for a second. Like, he basically gets a gigantic rock dropped on him.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, like, the implication is he wasn't invincible or immortal, right? He's still human. He just has powers.
Yeah, and he just had incredible defensive capabilities that would have prevented most things from killing him.
Right, but, like, a 10-ton rock landing on him was enough to do it.
Especially with him in the weakened state that he was in, because, so, the way they get him, the way he gets got, is that after, you know, having a spectacular brawl with Kirk and forcing Kirk to pray to him...
Oh, it's so good. That's so good. The acting there
is some of Shatner's best, like, body acting, I feel like.
Oh, there's just, like, the clasping of the hands, yep. The, like, oh, the... You could see the trying to fight it, but he can't fight
do it. But then, so Elizabeth
shirts ripping, and
yeah. But he convinces Elizabeth that she needs to stop Gary while she still can, and so they engage in God battle of wild hand gestures, and they kind of drain each other's powers a little bit, I think, and life force by doing this, which I believe rendered him in a weakened enough state to just get crushed by the rock.
I felt like he was trapped in the grave under the rock, and maybe Gary would come back. And some other, does Gary not come back?
I think you can assume the way his powers were increasing. If he was okay down there, he would have gotten out pretty quickly.
Yeah, so you assume he's squished like a
that,
little bug.
That's what they were trying to get across.
Yeah, that was my take as well.
But yeah, that's where the morality play stuff really just like reaches its apex, right? As he just straight up appeals to her.
Oh, the lecturing,
like,
yes.
Like you see what this increasingly unlimited power is doing to this guy. Like,
yes.
Like, what's the line? Like, be a psychiatrist for one more minute, for one more moment.
Retain your humanity.
And realize that humans were not meant to have this kind of power and stop this.
You must help me. Before it goes too far.
What he's doing is right. For him and me.
And for humanity, you're still human, at least partly you are. You wouldn't be here talking to me.
Earth is really unimportant. Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power? Will he acquire the wisdom?
Please go back while you still can.
Did you hear him joke about compassion? Above all else, a god needs compassion! Mitchell!
Elizabeth. What do you know about gods?
Then let's talk about humans. About our frailties. As powerful as he gets, he'll still have all that inside him.
Go back.
You were a psychiatrist once. You know the ugly, savage things we all keep buried, that none of us dare expose. But he'll dare. Who's to stop him? He doesn't need to care. Be a psychiatrist for 1 minute longer. What do you see happening to him? What's your prognosis, Doctor?
Right, because she's on the same path, right? If we didn't say it before, she is on the same path that Gary was. She's just a couple of days behind.
Yeah, like her ESP sensitivity was not as high as Gary's was to begin with, so it took longer for her stuff to start manifesting.
Yeah.
And that's when the line comes out. Absolute power, corrupting, absolutely.
Some good melodramatic TV sci-fi writing in this one.
Yes. She dies as well.
Her force is essentially drained, and she just can't. Yeah. She can't hack it after that.
Yeah, and they both at the end there. Kirk wants them both in the record as giving their life in the line of duty. Right.
Yeah. No sense in besmirching them. Might as well just say like, yeah, no, they went out doing their job, just like the other nine people who we never mentioned that also died in this episode.
He said something like, "Gary never asked for this. You know,
it's true.
He didn't ask for it."
Yeah, it's like record in her record that she served with distinction or something like that. And then he'd say he gave the same to Gary, even though Gary was a monster.
But he
never asked for this to happen.
Captain's log, stardate 13.8. Add to official losses, Dr. Elizabeth Dana. he had noted she gave her life in performance of her duty. Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell. Same notation. I want his service record to end that way. He didn't ask for what happened to him.
I felt for him, too.
I believe there's some hope for you after all, Mr. Spock.
And, you know,
it's a fun episode.
It's a fun episode, and there's a really good lesson in it, is that if you get to a barrier at the end of space that you know killed 200 people, you know, 200 years ago, don't fucking fly through it. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Hey, now they know.
I think it's a very similar, I mean, I don't, you guys know better than I do, or maybe this is, like, buckle up, Vinny, but, like, Charlie X has a similar trajectory here of too powerful to be integrated into humanity, right?
Yes.
Like, we cannot, even though the humane thing to do would be take care of this person and not eliminate them, too powerful for their own good? Is that just a Star Trek thing that will come up very often?
Kind of. They're laying it on real thick at the front of this series, though.
They are.
Like,
okay.
Like, Q is a recurring character. I mean, I can't speak to the rest of the original series, but in Next Generation, like, Q is a recurring character as a foil for Picard, but otherwise, like...
There's, like, a handful of episodes where things like this kind of happen, but
yeah,
it's not
like
a ton.
Outside of quote-unquote Q episodes, again, at least in that series, the, like, the number of other omnipotent beings is probably, like, count on one hand.
Yeah, or, like, close to it.
I feel like it's not even just omnipotent. It is the human dilemma, right? It is, oh, a human that gets too much power could never have this power because they don't have the responsibility. I think even Kirk says it at this point. Did he get the wisdom that goes along with this power? Or, you know, he just kind of shortcutted it and he's got too much power without the learning. There's a lot. You said it right. Like, the morality, like, it is a paragraph, a soliloquy of Kirk to go into why we can't have this.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I like it. This was definitely the one that Kirk seemed the... Seeing Kirk in these fights and do his thing, he is very hunky.
Mm-hmm.
He's very dashing. I thought he was very... I got why all the cliches of the dashing, you know, Starfleet commander came out of this. This was the one. He didn't seem like a goofball either. He seemed like...
Willing to sacrifice himself to save the ship and crew.
Yeah. And like, leave without me if you need to.
We get it.
So,
finally,
I like
you're now horned up for Kirk.
Oh, yeah, full, which is good going into our next episode.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll get to that episode here in just one moment, but we are going to take a quick break, and then we will get to The Naked Top. And we're back. And, folks, we got a doozy for you here. The Naked Time. This is the fourth episode. I'm going to say it again. I think 3 and 4 probably should have been 1 and 2 for this series because they make a pretty good 1-2 punch of different kinds of Star Trek stories and also just feel much better fleshed out than the other two episodes that started this off. But here we are. It's episode 4. And this is the episode so wacky, so good, they just straight up did it again in Next Generation.
I 10 minutes into this, I was like, man, this feels like it could be, this exactly feels like it could be a Next Generation episode. Completely.
And then it was.
Keep completely forgetting that they actually kind of did just make this again.
So
it's the second episode of Next Generation. If you count Encounter and Farpoint as one long episode, the second one is The Naked Now.
Is it really?
Which is this episode.
Oh, wow.
Is it the same, like, sickness? Or is it...
It's not the same idea. There's no continuity with it,
okay.
But the effect on the crew is the same that everybody... Except that episode, that version is way hornier than this one.
Way hornier. I mean,
can we... Okay. This one's pretty
horny.
Where do you
want to start this off? I can start with the history, or we can just talk about your feelings, Vinny, because you have feelings about this episode.
Well, first of all, my notes on this episode is this is the best episode so far. The
okay.
Other thing I would just like to start with is the opening scene of this, which I can only describe the costume design as I'm looking for something that is traditional Indian beekeeper's wedding, and I need Kirk to be in the Kirk and this other person to be in it. Because they're in giant, like, red... elaborate what
you're talking about, the bedazzled hazmat suits.
Yes, like their whole thing going on, which is like
yes.
like not
like
only
the veil part It's got this weird metal pattern on it. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do you see through that?
It's so the design of it is amazing, and I actually genuinely love it. But I couldn't. My wife and I were watching this, and I couldn't stop. Just it's amazing. The second thing is, they're supposed to. Like Spock is like, hey, don't make sure we got no contamination here. These things are not airtight at all. The dude's in there picking his nose with his hand up through the bottom of the helmet. He's touching walls with his bare hand. Like,
this guy doesn't know what the hell he's doing. I swear to God.
This is a military vessel. Why is everybody an idiot?
I mean, here's the thing. Humanity has been in space for a little while at this point, but we're still pretty dumb when it comes to most things related to space. We're still discovering a lot.
Like that part is such a blatant plot contrivance. It was just like, what the fuck are you doing?
He takes his hand out of the glove to scratch his nose.
Yeah,
I do love the little effect, though, of the... So he reaches out with his hand, and he touches something he's not supposed to. On this... Now abandoned, by abandoned I mean everyone's dead, science station on this frozen planet, on this planet that is collapsing in on itself. Yes. It is essentially going to implode. He takes his fucking, he reaches out, and then the goop that eventually infects him starts like floating up toward his hand, like it's being attracted to it, which is kind of a neat little visual effect, I think.
Yeah, it seems like they shot it at a weird angle to make it fall upward.
Yeah. But it's neat looking, and so the premise here is, he's become infected. He brings it back to the ship. And the infection is something that lowers the inhibitions of all the crew members who are infected and effectively creates the effect like they are drunk.
Yes.
Kind of emphasizes, I think they say it at one point, right? Like, kind of emphasizes whatever their sort of character traits that are lurking below the surface, like, suddenly come out and are emphasized or whatever.
This
first guy that gets it is like they say straight up, like, oh, his file shows he's like very prone to self-doubt, and like he is just freaking out constantly and tries to knife himself in the mess hall
with the butter
because they shouldn't be out there in
with
space.
With the butter knife.
You sure you're all right now, Joe? We've got to leave.
We're all a bunch of hypocrites. Stick our noses into something that we've got no business. What are we doing out here anyway?
Take it easy, Joe.
Bring pain and trouble with us. Leave men and women stuck out on freezing planets until they die. What are we doing out here in space? Good? What good? We're polluting it, destroying it. We've got no business being out here, no business.
Take it easy.
Now, calm down. If a man was supposed to fly, he'd have wings. If he was supposed to be out in space, he wouldn't need air to breathe. Wouldn't need life support systems to keep him from freezing to death.
Hey, Joey, put the knife down, huh?
You're all steamed up, Joe. We don't belong here. It's not ours. Not ours. Destroying and watching. We don't belong. I don't belong. 6 people died down there. Why do I deserve to live?
Also, he's right. Yeah, I mean, he is like, why are we out here messing around with stuff? We should have just left well enough alone. And you know what? Dude, you're the only one making sense right now.
How many times have I said out loud, Earth is a prison, we are never meant to leave?
He is right. Like, why are they out there? Just to observe and kind of record? Every mission so far has had at least a few people die. And this guy is about to off himself with a butter knife in the mess hall. I was going to say, I do want to hear the history at some point.
Yeah, we'll get there. Okay. Brad, what did you want to ask?
They're there to observe this planet breaking up.
Right.
Yes,
collapsing on itself.
Speaking of their mission, like, they're here to watch this planet, like, destroy itself.
So ridiculous.
A planet that is basically all but devoid of life. So this isn't even, like, a particularly, like, big prime directive, you know, like, interference thing. Like, it's just, no, this planet has been frozen and shitty for, like, hundreds and hundreds of years. The sun died forever ago. So now this planet is just collapsing in on itself. So we're purely here to observe the effect.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a bit of, I mean, this was before, but it's got a bit of like the thing kind of this parasite or this sickness was frozen on this planet, right? Like it is.
Well, they determine it's the water. Like the water on the planet contains an enzyme that they could not previously detect. Mm. And that is the thing. That's why it also transfers through perspiration and touch.
Yeah, it was
I'm
sorry. It's some pseudoscientific hand wave.
Yes.
Honestly.
They do a lot of that.
So give me this history.
All right, so the history here, this is a shorter one. This was actually originally intended as a two-part episode. If you are wondering why the end of this episode just has a quick nod to time travel for no fucking reason, that's why.
Huh. Okay.
Okay.
So that, they reworked it so that the second part becomes a later episode in this season called Tomorrow is Yesterday. But they decided not to do that for this one for whatever reason. Don't know why. But that is why they just all of a sudden there's time travel in the last 5 minutes of this episode.
It's, yes, it is bonkers. And my note for that when I was watching it is, wait, what? You traveled in time and we're just going to keep that in our fucking pocket?
Like, apparently.
It's literally like the last 3 minutes of the episode.
Yeah.
And Kirk's like, well, that's good to know. Well, maybe we'll use that later.
There is a thing with time travel in this series where there are 1,000 different ways to do it. They discover a new one almost every time, and then they forget about it immediately.
Okay. Well, more on that maybe when we get to the end of the episode.
Yeah. So this was written by John D.F. Black, who was an associate producer on the show. He eventually went on to write for Hawaii Five-0, Mission Impossible, Streets of San Francisco, and also did a couple episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. He also co-wrote the script for Shaft.
Nice.
Huh. Okay.
So there you go.
Nice.
It was directed by Mark Daniels, who did 15 episodes of this show. George Takei counts this as his favorite episode of the series, and I can imagine why.
Fuck.
He gets to do some shit in this episode, including fencing, which is not something he knew how to do prior to this episode. So when he was told he had to learn how to fence, he spent all his downtime during filming practicing and would apparently frequently sneak up on cast and crew and poke them when they didn't know he was there, to the point where the crew told Gene Roddenberry, if you ever give him a sword again, we quit. This is also the first official appearance of Majel Barrett's Nurse Chapel.
I did not realize that was Majel Barrett. I don't know how I didn't put that together.
She's very young here, and we're used to her as Deanna Troi's mom, you know, the MILF of the galaxy.
Oh, she comes back in is that Next Generation?
She is both the computer voice and Deanna Troi's mom in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, wow, okay. And that's Roddenberry's wife.
Yes, Roddenberry's wife.
A later wife.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Not at this
long-time
time.
Long-time partner.
I don't believe at this time.
Okay.
Yeah, they were not married yet, but like this was that period where Gene Roddenberry, I think, had multiple relationships going at once.
He's a huge philanderer.
Okay.
Some other guest stars include Bruce Hyde as Kevin Riley, who is an actor that mostly went on to do to become a college professor. He didn't do a ton of acting.
He's the singing guy?
Yes, he's the singing Irishman. And William Knight, who is he has a small part in this. I mostly noted him because he does a ton of goes on to do a ton of anime and video game voice acting.
Okay.
He's in like Ghost of the Shell, Standalone Complex, Cowboy Bebop, Paranoia Agents, Naruto. Like he does a ton of small roles and stuff.
Who is he in this episode?
He has like a one line thing. Like he's sort of like a horny crewman, I think. Amorous crewman is how he is referred to.
Oh, is he the
here.
One who blocks
Gilman Rand?
Yeah, from
I
getting in the
so,
elevator?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's that guy.
Okay.
This is also the only episode where Uhura, Rand, and Nurse Chapel are all in the episode.
Okay.
Because Rand, again, does not last super long through this season, and Chapel is not on every episode.
Okay.
That's really the main historical stuff. Now we can get to the stupid shit.
I'm just going to say, while I've got in front of me, also Paramount Plus apparently figured out how to stop you from taking screenshots of it, because I was going to show you guys.
Aww.
There's really good character lighting in this episode.
Yes,
there
after
is. Yeah.
After you were talking about it not being great in the pilot, even past the like bar of light on the eyes stuff, like there's just a lot of good dramatic shadow on people when they're in focus, and like I'm looking at the shot of like Kirk like kind of shouldering next to Spock looking at this viewfinder, and there's this like blue light across his eyes coming out of this computer thing he's looking at. It's like really nice looking.
Yeah, this episode looks great. Like I noticed it when I was watching it. This was like a really well shot episode.
It was also I would say this one is very good as far as just like putting certain cast members in their best light, because George Takei has never been more oily and swashbuckling than he is in this episode, and he looks incredible.
He looks
when he has
fantastic.
His shirt off.
He's running around. Yeah. Everybody's very sweaty, so the hissing sickness or whatever it is, the rattlesnake sickness.
Yeah, it definitely
have.
Makes a weird snake noise when it moves over to you. I think that's the only way they could denote that this person has been infected.
Makes you perspire, which I guess is, you know, said to, that's how it transmits to other people, is through perspiration. But Everybody becomes very sweaty, and at some point, Sulu is like, let's go just work out, man. Want to just go exercise?
Leaves the bridge while they're in the middle of a navigational disaster.
He's just super happy to go downstairs, get some exercise in, some fencing, and then the next time you see him, shirt off, just
running around the ship.
Like, shot of George Takei with a fencing saber, shirtless, looking absolutely ripped, is like... I feel like that's up there with like famous shots from the show, right?
Mm. Like top 10 all time.
Like that was absolutely like seeing him fencing in that hallway. It was something I've seen for like years and years.
I feel like I've seen that. And the only other one that comes to mind immediately is the tribbles, like a tribbles falling out of a ceiling. Like that's or the little like dolls, whatever they are. So like he's great. And he's just manic.
That was why I was like, I bet this is his favorite episode. Cause he gets to like capital A act constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And also looks amazing shirtless. Like
everybody's going for it.
It's like a tour de force for him and some of the other actors.
My favorite thing, my little detail, is that every time one of them gets infected early on, Spock has to be the one to state the obvious of what personality trait has come out. So, like, you know, with the one guy, it was crippling self-doubt to the point where even after McCoy operated on him, he just said, nah, I don't want to live anymore, like subconsciously, and just fucking turned himself off.
Yeah. Also, is McCoy not a good doctor? Like
he is.
No, he's fine.
Okay, because he seemed like he couldn't save this guy, and then was like, I don't really know why I couldn't save this guy.
I mean, he says it like he should be alive. Yeah. Everything I did was right. Like nothing, there was nothing latent in his body that should have shown him to die.
I didn't really put that. I was confused and did not put that together when he died. But I think what Alex just explained makes sense. That like the guy was so hopeless that he literally just died of hopelessness.
Yeah, but then Riley is, he believes himself descended from Irish kings,
That's his personality trait that is amped up, is that he hella loves being Irish.
Yep, bless him. And then Spock's like, Sulu apparently fancies himself something of a 16th century swashbuckler.
Yes.
Fascinating, a pattern is developing. First, Tormolin, hidden personality traits being forced to the surface. Then Riley, who fancies himself a descendant of Irish kings. Now Sulu, who is at heart a swashbuckler out of your 18th century.
Which
does not come up again, I don't think, by the way. I don't think that's a trait that Sulu has repeatedly.
I mean, I've seen enough Star Trek where I know he wants his own ship, right?
Yeah, he wants his own ship because he wants to get away from William Shatner.
That's instead of crossover.
I'm not lying. That's why they gave him his own ship in 6, because he did not want to do more scenes with Shatner.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a metatextual thing, I guess. Yeah. But, like, I have to... say I was preparing for way more like lascivious sort of encounters in this, knowing that Roddenberry was at the helm. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of surprised that it was not particularly sleazy for the most part.
Yeah, there's a little of it here and there, like the crewman that corners Rand, and you know, but it's more people confessing feelings to one another and just kind of acting like dipshits than it is any like real sleaze.
Like compared to like, you know, the next generation version of this is like an excuse to put Denise Crosby in a skimpy outfit and play out some weird self-insert fantasies and stuff.
This thing isn't terminal though, right? It just like the planet didn't fall apart or freeze over or do anything because the people were
it's literally a chemical in the water,
right?
Yeah, so, I think the implication is that everybody probably just eventually loses their instinct for self-preservation.
Okay, right. So it's not going to kill you necessarily, it's just you're not going to take care of yourself or do what you need to do.
They basically are like, well, not true of every person, but I started to say like a lot of people are going to like party themselves to death.
Right.
Yeah.
And
the thing, the other thing that directly mirrors the TNG episode is that there is a very imminent, like, ship threat that is attached to all of this, which in this case, I actually think is kind of awesome. It's probably one of the more, like, interesting race against time things that I remember from this series, which is that the ship is slowly decaying in orbit into the imploding planet.
Yeah.
And they have, like, and the fucking Irish guy locked himself in the engineering room and turned off the engines.
It's really tense. Like, it's really uncomfortable, like, watching the view screen of the planet just gets closer and closer and fills more of the screen. It was, like, pretty gripping and uncomfortable.
Orbit keeps getting faster.
Like, both of these episodes make me want to go back and watch the non-doctored, like, original effects versions of these things to see what they did, because, like, in both cases, the effects look way too good for what I believe they could pull off in 1966.
Yeah.
The ones I've gone back and looked at, there are certain effects that look similar, but a lot of them are way crunchier, obviously way more low res. And so like they're lit in such a way that like you can kind of you can only kind of discern what's actually going on there. It just, it looks like a model that's being held in front of a camera in a lot of cases. So
yeah, is this one of the few times also that McCoy physically opens up a patient? Like he's got him opened up in his inside. I thought they don't do that in Star Trek. Like, they have to open you up. I thought they have all their special scanning tools.
It depends. There are definitely times when he has to perform straight up surgery.
Oh, okay.
And that's true even further into the series. But like, there's a lot of stuff that is very much hand waved away by like, we put a thing over their abdomen and there's like a view screen into it, and then I press some buttons. You know?
But people are still cutting people open in Star Trek.
Yeah, like laser scalpels and things like that do exist.
All right. I love the ticking time pressure on this one. I agree it is.
It's harrowing.
It's going back to the episode we just saw where Kirk is dashing. Kirk loses his shit in this one. Like Kirk.
Yes. Even Kirk, before he's infected.
There's a great part where the guy just keeps singing over the intercom. And at some point he and Uhura just are like, he's like, shut him the fuck up. He's like, I can't shut him up. I'm sorry.
Like, Captain, don't you think if I could, I would. And then yeah. They both apologize to each other.
Please try and cut him off.
Sir, if I could cut him off, don't you think I...
Yes, sir, I'll keep trying. Sorry.
Like, he is losing it. And they have to... What are they... There's another good scene where Scotty isn't infected. He's one of the only people that's not. And he's got to cut through the panel... And
but not hit the wrong wiring, otherwise he'll fuck everything up.
Wire, yeah. And Kirk's like, you need to go faster, and kind of walks away. And then Spock comes back later and is like, he's like, I can't go any faster. It's going to take me, what does he say? Something like, it's going to take me 22 minutes to get through this. And Spock is like, that is 1 minute. That's a minute and a half longer than we have to live, which I thought was great. Like, it was like a great line of like you empathize with Scotty, and you're like, shit, there's nothing I can do. Like, I got to go faster.
Message from the captain.
Tell him I'm doing my best. If I cut through the wrong circuits...
We have 14 minutes left.
Even if we were under full-scale attack, I couldn't move any faster, not maintain a safety factor.
At the rate you're proceeding, calculations show that you'll take a minute and a half, more than we have left. You can't afford a safety factor.
I genuinely think this is the first episode where it feels like not only do they get the characterization of Spock right... But also they open him up a little bit in some ways. Like once he gets infected, you can kind of see him wrestling with his emotional state in a way that like obviously he hasn't done up to this point. But they don't lay it on too thick yet, because there's more to come with that later in the series.
Oh, it's like, pretty like thick.
That scene, that one scene of him by himself where he stumbles into the room and has this emotional breakdown, like I felt like I was in a theater. Like
yes.
I genuinely felt like I was like watching a stage actor.
Oh yeah.
Like hear a pin drop, like give this, like, yeah.
There is a, there's an old internet video that is one of the first things my partner sent to me when we were dating. I only remember this because it was one of the first things. It is a extremely erotically edited video of just Kirk and Spock footage where it is more or less implied that they're building up to fucking. And it is all set to Nine Inch Nails Closer.
Okay.
And this is the first episode we've seen where footage from that is in the episode. This where Spock is slapping fucking Kirk around in that room.
It's Kirk. Kirk slaps Spock first.
They slap each other around, but Spock wins.
So my wife said that Vulcans are stronger than humans. Is that a?
They are a little bit, yes.
Okay, because he tosses him across the room.
Is this also? I think this is maybe also the first appearance of the Nerf Pinch.
This episode is canonically the first appearance of the Vulcan nerve pinch.
And like they kind of don't address it other than I think Kirk very offhandedly is like, I got to learn how to do that someday.
Yeah, you got to teach me that sometime.
So Spock gets infected, and then I forget her name, but the Roddenberry's would-be wife.
Nurse Chapel
is infected also, and she professes her love for Spock. And this is where you get Spock... You get a lot of, like, the human side. She says something about Spock having human blood in him as well.
Yes.
Spock then goes off, like Brad said, into this, like, dim all the lights performance of what is a man? I have battled my I've kept it bottled up, my logical side, my emotional side, and I can't
I control my emotions, and then he breaks down, and then, I control them, like...
And it's, like, it's a little much where he's, like, sitting, and then he's, like...
Yeah.
Something like, what to do? What, two, four, six. You know, he's like, the logical side.
It almost feels like he's doing Hamlet or something. Like, yes. Almost.
So at this point, do you understand the nature? I mean, you know that Vulcans are logical creatures, but do you understand the nature of their emotions and how they're stifled?
So she says something here, which I asked my wife about. She said something like, oh, I know how they treat the women on your planet.
Mr. Spock. The men from Vulcan treat their women strangely. At least people say that. But you're part human, too. I know you don't. You couldn't hurt me, would you?
And I was like, whoa, what the hell happens on the Vulcan planet?
So that is not a thing that I really remember. I feel like they're not, like, there are, like, powerful women in Vulcan society, I think.
She was like, my wife was just like, it's emotionless. Like, there's no, you know, yeah. I think she's referring to it being kind of a sterile relationship.
I think Chapel also says something along the lines of, like, I've heard.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't sound super definitive. I don't know for a fact. This seems like an idea they probably abandoned.
Mm.
If I had to guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
They do go on and say Spock's mom is human.
She's human. So, like, Vulcans already have fairly intense, violent emotions, but they have, you know, trained themselves in sort of a monastic way.
Oh, okay.
To essentially, like, get them under control, to use logic, to use their supreme intelligence to create, like, a barrier for their emotions. And Spock has it bad because he also has human blood and human emotions that come along with that. So he's basically stifling two different kinds of emotions, more or less.
And so is he, when he's having his moment here, does he go into, I can't remember clearly, but does he go into a thing about his mom having to be on that planet?
There is
a bit on there about, he basically is like lamenting the fact that she had to exist on a planet. I think something along the lines of like, be a human on a loveless planet or something.
Okay.
Like that.
Yes. Mm. Okay. That's in this. Okay. And like, That whole scene is really interesting. The character, yeah. It's the first time I think you guys acknowledge this. You really get some insight into Spock and the troubles Spock might have later on, the challenges. Because Kirk has a moment later, and it's like not nearly as effective. Kirk is just
melting down. Like, he's just not handling any of this well, and it's understandable. Like, he was tense beforehand, but once he's infected, it's just like, that dude doesn't know what to fucking do with himself.
Kirk is like maybe getting horny for the ship, but
that,
then also,
okay, I was gonna ask, I couldn't tell if that breakdown at the end was about a woman or a ship. I thought it might be the ship.
They might occupy the same space in his brain.
Well, he also is like kind of lamenting that he's the captain and can't hit on like the nice women, like the women on a crew, and the ship is not flesh, and like this whole thing that's just like, oh man, we gotta get away from Kirk for a little.
Kirk
we gotta
needs
go
some alone time.
We gotta go.
Love. You're better off without it, and I'm better off without mine. This vessel. I give. She takes. She won't permit me my life. I've got to live hers.
Jim.
I have a beautiful yeoman. Have you noticed her, Mr. Spock? You're allowed to notice her. The captain's not permitted.
Jim. There is an intermix formula.
Now I know why. It's called she.
It's never been tested. It's a theoretical relationship between time and antimatter.
Flesh woman to touch, to hold. A beach to walk on. A few days, no braid on my shoulder. Captain.
Scotty. Help.
But
the thing I didn't get though is how Spock like overcomes the sickness. Like it just kind of turns off for him, and I never quite figured out what was going on there.
I think maybe the implication is that through sheer force of will, he's able to stifle it the way that he stifles the rest of his emotional responses.
I figured that was the case. That feels like kind of a hand wave to me, but
yeah.
Well,
I think that's what they do.
It felt a little convenient, but sure.
He comes through in the crisis because it's after the slap fight. Also, I think Kirk slaps a computer at some point, too. He's slapping everything. The Scotty,
but never a woman.
Never a woman. You can't. There's no good way, as he said. Is it Kirk? Somebody at the Spock is like, we have to implode the engines. We have to do this like weird. What is it? Like make dark matter. We have to transmute matter and antimatter formula that needs to happen. And that's when Kirk kind of turns it, or Spock kind of turns it around and is like, yes, there is a formula. I'm okay now. Let's go figure this all out.
Well, yeah. So the thing is that because the engines are completely off, it takes 30 minutes to bring them back online from a cold start.
Right.
They don't have that much time. They have like 12 at this point. So Kirk is trying to get Spock to come up with a plan, to have an idea, because you're so smart, goddammit, think of something. And then he finally comes up and is like, okay, there's this concept. There's this formula for matter, antimatter implosion, but it's never been tested. Or if it has been tested, it's never worked. So there's like, fuck it, do it. We don't have a choice.
And Spock, that's kind of when Spock snaps out of it and is okay. While Kirk, there's a good moment here where Kirk is clearly aware of what's happening to him and trying to fight through it and make his way to the bridge all sweaty and
climped.
You know, he's trying to keep his cool with the crew. But meanwhile, McCoy has figured out the antidote and has given it to Sulu, and that's it so far, and like runs through the bridge.
Yeah. He gives the limited amount he has to the bridge crew.
Rips off Kirk's shirt.
That was such a man. He just like strides onto the bridge and literally just rips Kirk's sleeve off with one hand and just jabs him.
It's so baller.
Without a word.
I love it.
And gets Kirk going back on track there. And I think the other part I like is like when they bust into the singing Irish guy, they just haul him out of there.
They just manhandle him out of there.
They're
instantly
so sick of his shit. And there is a Scotty, you mentioned it earlier, Scotty's in the tubes putting little tiny weights or whatever on wires. Are those Jeffrey's tubes? Is that what you guys?
Yes. They don't come out and say it, but I was very surprised to get a maintenance tube scene in this. I didn't know that they did that in this series.
They don't do it a lot, if I remember correctly, but they do it, like, the Jeffrey's tube as a concept exists.
Once they get the back online, they do the formula thing, and then the fucking weirdest shit in the episode starts happening all within a minute and a half. Like, there's a line, they do it, the planet, I guess, implodes or collapses on itself, and then so they say they're imploding the engines, and they say it worked. The engines imploded.
So the way that warp engines, and I cannot explain this in actual great detail because I've never fully understood this, but basically matter-antimatter reactions, fusion, is a thing that powers warp engines. What they are doing is essentially a reverse effect to some degree to basically cold fusion the fucking engines, just like cold start it, make it go. Whatever this effect is not a thing that you are supposed to do with these engines, but in this case, it just fucking jump starts them and they just like shoot to warp, but backwards warp.
Well, they say they're going faster than is physically or is possible.
Yeah, is known.
Yeah, and so they're going backwards in time.
I mean, this is an early example of like a lot of the techno babble in Star Trek just serves the plot.
Yes.
And then he says, start the engine. So that I thought the engines were gone, but the engines are just the reaction is imploded. Is that what?
Yeah. They haven't destroyed the engines. It's just a kind of a quick, a risky jump start kind of situation.
Okay. So implosion in this case is just the reaction.
It's like an implosion of the fuel or something. Yeah.
Okay. So they start the engines and then they slow back down the time. And basically Spock's like, yeah, we've traveled through time. We're 3 days earlier. And just Kirk kind of laughs it off. Is like, I don't want to relive those 3 days. Let's keep that in our back pocket. Now that we know what time travel is. Smile. The end. Fade out.
The end. Yeah.
Yep.
Whoops, traveled in time.
Like a shot of the bridge crew at the end. Like, again, well shot and like a nice shot of everybody standing around.
It's a great shot of them that makes you think that shot was intended to be them realizing the weight of the fact that they just traveled through fucking time.
Uh-huh.
But then the second part of that didn't happen. Because that episode doesn't come until much later in the season and is not actually related to this episode, like, directly.
Huh. Should not ask too many questions about the time travel stuff.
No, by all means.
Well, you can ask. It's just, or I guess what I would say is that the show itself doesn't take the answers all that seriously.
But that guy's dead, right?
Which guy?
The guy that died from terminal.
Oh yeah, no, the time travel didn't bring anyone back to life.
Did it bring the planet back?
It's probably there for another 3 days.
I would say everything that existed outside of the ship's static warp bubble is probably where
they
it was 3 days ago, and
could,
everything inside the ship has continuity with previous events.
Could they go get the guy and bring him back to the ship so he doesn't die?
No, okay, because now the flow of time within the ship was never disrupted, so he's still dead.
But how about Kirk and Spock and the guy that go down in the beekeeper outfits on the planet? Are they before that happened? Or
okay,
they,
now you're getting into the bullshit.
Like, are Spock and that guy? If the guy's dead, he can't go down to the planet. If there's not another Enterprise, you know what I mean? They can't get the disease in the first place, which would cause them to implode the engines. So if it's 3 days and it's before those guys go on their away mission,
Vinny. Telling you right now,
yeah,
it's going to be at least 30 years until Star Trek has a time paradox that is solved satisfactorily.
Okay. Fair
enough. He's not wrong about that.
Okay, wait, but they do actually solve one?
They solve one, and literally they make the entire last episode of Next Generation about it, and that is why they solve it satisfactorily, because they actually try.
Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, they introduce too much crap with just that one line. It's just, it's ridiculous.
You don't think, God dang it, what is the name of the episode?
Which one?
The name. Cause and Effect. You don't think Cause and Effect was resolved satisfactorily?
Oh, which one's Cause and Effect?
It's where they're stuck in the loop, reliving the same events over and over that ends with the ship being destroyed every time.
Okay, here's the thing. That's not a paradox, because they're just stuck in a loop.
Oh, sure, okay. Fair.
The paradox aspect of it is different.
Okay, isn't one of the movies, though, like Kirk and Picard?
Yeah,
on
it doesn't... Oh, well, that's Generations. That's less a time thing and more an alternate dimension thing.
It's more like Shatner got whisked away to an alternate dimension for 50 years, 60 years, whatever it ends up being.
Okay.
He ends up in a reality outside of time, basically.
I mean, the movie with the whales is time.
Yeah, I was going to say that one. They travel back in time on that one, obviously.
Oh, and that one has some of the most time travel bullshit of all bullshit, so...
So I will say the end of this episode is when my girlfriend expressed her growing admiration for James Kirk.
Just took two shirt rips and
it was not the shirt so much as the I don't know. I think it's the heroism. She said it was more his like responsibility and sense of duty and like concern for the crew's safety and stuff like that that really put it over the top for her.
I think he does a great job. Where he's gritting his teeth to get back to the bridge where, you know, everybody else has kind of collapsed. And there's a couple of scenes. And again, I think it has to do with how well shot it is, where you get the sense that he realizes he's infected and has to still do his duty and not just sing like the rest of the crew. And I thought, these two have put Kirk on a different level for me, where I thought he was just a Mr. Magoo bumbling Starfleet commander.
Again. It's almost like these might have been better episodes to start the series off with, but, you know,
and also
it is what it is.
Also
very
I wouldn't worry about your partner getting into Kirk unless she starts buying William Shatner's albums. That's when it has gone too far.
Well, there's a difference between Kirk and Shatner, right? Like,
there's a big difference between Kirk and Shatner,
for sure,
let me tell you.
Huge, huge. Also, she's allowed to buy Nimoy's albums any day.
Mm.
Absolutely, yes. No, Nimoy is unassailable.
I came away with these being like, oh, okay, he is a kind of dashing, in every sense of the word, like commander, like they get into some of he's more by the book than I thought he would be at this point. Like,
yeah, me too.
I thought he was like throw the book out the window. In my mind, this was like he just charges forward, and Spock is always the one that's a tactician. But you know, it's like a balance. It's not as black and white as that.
There will be some episodes coming up. I don't know if they're in this season or not, but there are some episodes where they get way into the weeds with how great a tactician Kirk is. There is one episode where I think is the first one where the Romulans show up that is basically a submarine battle in space, and it is an all-timer in terms of like James T. Kirk fucking mind-forcing his way out of a dire situation.
James R. Kirk, thank you very much.
I'm never going to say that again.
Also, I know we're still early on, four episodes in. Do Kirk and McCoy hate each other?
No. There's a respect there. It's a mostly professional respect. But like Bones is supposed to be kind of a brusque personality, not mean, just like, you know, just kind of a gruff guy. And Kirk is not that. So I think they just sometimes run afoul of one another.
Okay. Because I think it was in this episode where in the Naked
Well, it'd have
time.
To be because there's no McCoy in the other
Yes,
one.
In the Naked Time where it just seems like you guys fucking just hate work on the same ship and you just hate each other. It was after that patient dies and he's like, I don't know why he died. And it's like, figure it out.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like, he's like, I've done everything possible to try to figure this out. He's like, well, I need you to do the impossible, Bones.
Yeah. It's like, huh.
Kirk doesn't like it when things aren't explained.
Yeah.
He's got to lead with his heart.
Well, folks, that is these two episodes in the books. Now, when we return to the world of Star Trek, the original series, we'll be moving on to episodes 5 and 6. Those are, hang on, I'm looking them up right now.
I've got them here.
Why don't you give them to me right now?
The Enemy Within.
Mm-hmm.
And Mudd's Women.
Ah, yes, the one we mentioned earlier. Harry Mudd's first appearance.
I have no idea what a Harry Mudd is.
Harry Mudd is sort of a space pirate of, you know, not particularly, like, he's not a lethal space pirate, more of like a bumbling fool type.
Okay.
But yeah, so we'll be doing those episodes in 2 weeks. However, and this is where I, your host, Alex, am punching in here to let you know that we are going to be doing a theme for the month of August. We had our Mission Control and Mysterious Benefactor patrons vote over on our Patreon, and we gave them some categories, some different ideas for movies that we could do in August, and they voted, and by the thinnest of thin margins, they have chosen the sub-genre. These are some submarine flicks that we are excited to check out, some of which we have not seen. Brad has never seen our next movie, which will be 1990s Tom Clancy adaptation, The Hunt for Red October. And then in a couple weeks after that, we are going to do the Tony Scott thriller from 1995, Crimson Tide. And then we will be closing out the month of August with the German U-boat classic, Das Boot, the director's cut. Yes, all 3 hours and 30 minutes of it. And that is how we are going to rock the month of August. And obviously in between there, we'll be doing more Star Trek episodes. But for next week's show, get ready to hunt down the Red October and also try to hunt down exactly what kind of accent Sean Connery is going for as we watch The Hunt for Red October. That's going to do it for this week here on the Next Lander Watchcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Vinny and Brad. We'll see you next time.